last time.
I'm the motherfucking rhinoceros. My beasts are fat and the buds are on my back and I'm horny.
I'm horny.
If you choose to proceed, you will indeed concede. Cause I hit you with my flow, the wild rhyme will stampede. I'm not just wild, I'm trained, domesticated. I was raised by a rapper and rhino that dated and subsequently procreated. That's how it goes. Here's the hip-hop-hopotamus, the hip-hop-hippo.
They call me the hip-hop-hopotamus. My lyrics are bottomless.
Sometimes my rhymes are polite, and I thank you for dinner, Miss Wright. That was very delicious. Good night. Sometimes they're obscene, like a pornographic dream. NC-17 with ladies in a stream of margarine. Ha 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 ha. Yeah, some margarine.
They call me the hip-hop-hopotamus. Flows that glow like phosphorus. Popping off the top of this esophagus. Rocking this metropolis. I'm not a large water-dwelling mammal. Where did you get that preposterous hypothesis? Did Steve tell you that perchance? Steve.
My rhymes and records, they don't get played. Because my records and rhymes, they don't get made. And if you rap like me, you don't get paid. And if you roll like me, you don't get laid.
My rhymes are so potent that in this small segment I made all of the ladies in the area pregnant. Yeah, sometimes my lyrics are sexist, but you lovely bunch of Joe should know I'm trying to correct this.
Other rappers dismay, say my rhymes are sissy. Why?
Exactly?
What? Why?
Be more constructive with your feedback, please. Why?
Why? Why? Cause I rap about reality. Like me and my grandma drinking a cup of tea. There ain't no party like my nana's tea party. Hi, ho. I'm the mother flippin'.
I'm the mother flippin'.
I'm the mother flippin'.
Who's the mother flippin'?
I'm the mother flippin'.
I'm the mother flippin'.
I'm the mother flippin'.
Mother flippin'.
Hello, I'm Matt Everett, and you're listening to The First Time on BBC Six Music and BBC Sounds. This is the show where we meet some of the most influential and best-loved musicians around and take a look at the pivotal first musical moments that made them who they are today. Today's guest is a special one. A musician, definitely, but also a singer, a songwriter, an actor, a comedian, an Academy Award winner, a friend of the Muppets, possibly an enemy of Morrissey, one half of Flight of the Conchords, and the rhinoceros himself. I'm very pleased to welcome to The First Time this week, Brett McKenzie. And you were just listening to Hip Hop Hippopotamus versus Rhinoceros by Flight of the Conchords from their first TV series and album back in 2008. In this show, I'll speak to Brett all about the music that made an impact on him during his childhood, his early forays into performing, and his passion for funk and breakdancing. We also cover his first impressions of his Flight of the Conchords bandmate, Jermaine Clement, his own solo music, which includes a brand new record called Songs Without Jokes, and his passion for Bowie, Leonard Cohen, and Nick Drake, as well as discussing getting an Oscar for his work with the Muppets music, and also if we're ever going to have another Flight of the Conchords series or album. But I started by asking Brett, as I do with all my guests, when was the first time he was aware of music as a kid?
The first time I remember music as a kind of thing was driving around in my dad's horse truck. My father is a horse trainer, and he had this rickety old horse truck that rattled away with a few horses in the back, and we'd sit up in the front in the cab, my brother and I, and he would play Billy Joel and Conway Twitty cassette tapes, and he'd sing along very enthusiastically, and so would we.
Wish that I was on a rocky top down in the Tennessee hill. Ain't no smoggy smoke up on rocky top, ain't no telephone bill. Once I had a girl on a rocky top, half bare the other half.
Was music kind of a big deal in your house then? I guess it was.
My dad was a singer. He's a sort of Renaissance man, a singer, a lawyer, and a horse trainer. And
well, that's a pretty strong combo.
Yeah, yeah. He gave up law for a more reliable career in horse racing. But he'd been a singer as a younger man, so he loved singing. He has a great big baritone, beautiful big voice. Yeah, so we sang a lot. He spent a lot of time trying to get us to sing. You know, we'd be in the bath, and he'd make us sing loudly to try and. He's always teaching us how to project to this imaginary audience in the bathroom that we had no idea what he was talking about. He still keeps trying to improve my singing style.
And then, to this day.
And then my mother was and still is a dance teacher. and during the day she ran a contemporary dance company. So she wasn't a singer or a musician, but she had music playing all day long at the studio, and we would, my brothers and I, we all learnt ballet as kids, and so we were listening to piano. That was back in the time where they had, you know, a real pianist in the room playing the music for all the kids doing ballet. So I was very familiar with live piano. And also, this is three first times. Sorry, it's not very good, not very succinct answer. But my grandfather was a great piano player. So he would come over smoking his pipe, drinking cups of Lapsang Souchong tea, and sit on the piano. And he could play the piano up and, you know, one of those guys who could just go up and down the piano playing big classical, beautiful songs.
What was the first pop music that you were into then? What was the first kind of single that you got really into? Can you remember?
I really liked Footloose, the soundtrack to Footloose.
That's a good soundtrack.
Let's hear it for the boy. I guess I...
That's a good song.
I really embraced that one as a boy. it championed me. and I guess maybe from growing up in a house of doing dance, I really loved the Footloose dance kind of story. And so I had that cassette tape. I was really into that. The other one I had was a Breakdance 2 volume, which was a breakdance compilation, because I also liked breakdancing as a 9-year-old. 8 or 9-year-old, I was really into backspins and dolphin dives. So that's where I think my fascination with like vocoders and electro sort of zap, electro kind of funk came from.
Already there are signs of the musical influences that would emerge later on in your career. It's all there.
They are there, the start, actually. They are. Yeah.
Were drums the first instrument that you learned, or was it a bit of piano then drums? And why drums?
We all had to learn piano as a kid. So piano was the first thing I learned. You know, after school lessons for piano. And then at high school, when I started to veer away from ballet, you know, at school they sometimes do a thing, I don't know if they do this in the UK, but all the kids would write down what they thought the other kid was going to be when they grow up.
No, we're the thing where you have to write who you think you're going to be, but not someone else. That's cruel.
Oh, right. Yeah, no, you wrote other people's things. And they all said I was going to be a ballet dancer. That was my trajectory at that point. I was like going to be a professional ballet dancer. But somewhere as a teenager, my career changed, and I became interested in music more than dance, and I picked up the drum kit, playing drums at school. And you could do drum lessons at high school, and you got to go out of class to do music lessons. So, at 10:30, you could go and do your drum lesson, which was just, we thought this was brilliant. We started picking up as many instruments as we could, because you could just say, oh, I've got to go to a music lesson and disappear from class. And you could just go to the music department, and there wasn't a very structured system of checking if you were, you know, actually doing a lesson. You could sort of sift around looking for instruments in the storeroom and just play drums and synthesizers. And at this one point, we started a xylophone techno electronic music band, three of us. We would just drop out of class, go to our xylophone lessons, and three of us would
what
play.
What was the band called?
We didn't really have a name, but we just played sort of like techno, but on, because techno was just kicking off around there. And so we played sort of xylophone rave music in the music department in the 90s in Wellington. It's very early Wellington dance music scene. Just the three of us, three or four of us dancing.
So, like, as a drummer, who did you want to be?
I wanted to be James Brown's drummer. I wanted to be a funk drummer.
set your sights at like one of the greatest bands of all time.
Yeah. It was Louis Jordan and James Brown. Those feels like there's a song called Something for Fred, where the beat goes dum ka tikka tikka boom ka dum ka tikka tikka boom tikka boom, and that was the feel that I was just obsessed with. And then that led on to Funky Drummer, which is a classic James Brown sample. And this is around the time it started getting sampled. That was when the samples kicked off, and that's one of the most sampled drum loops. But we already knew, like, my friends were like, this is an amazing drum feel. And then it started showing up in every song. We'll be right back. But yeah, I'd been sitting there practicing for hours just trying to figure out those funk feels. Never quite figured it out, but yeah, that was my joy for a few years there, playing funk drums.
You were kind of used to performing because of the sort of ballet and the sort of theatre stuff, but what was the first gig that you played as a musician? Was it any good? What was the band? Had they got a terrible name? I love school band names.
My school band was called the Blue Samanthas.
That's actually quite a good name.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure who came up with that name in the group. It was like five of us. It was an instrumental sort of funk band. Two trumpets, bass drums, and electric guitar. Guitar player was obsessed with the Bee Gees and would play these like funk disco riffs. And geniusly, Age, the guitar player, Age Pryor, he's the musician now as well, he came up with a scheme to do a tour of our town's girls' schools. So right. Like Wellington has a lot of, I'm not sure if this is the same in the UK, but we have a lot of single sex high schools. So there's lots of boys' schools and lots of girls' schools and only one co-ed school here. So I'm not sure why it's so traditional. So we were in a single-sex, quite traditional Wellington College, you know, grey uniform, ties and everything. And then he organised a tour of the five girls' schools during the day at lunchtime. So we did this tour, like Monday this girls' school, Tuesday this girls' school. And we're 14 or 15. Somehow he managed to convince these schools to let us go in and like play the lunchtime. No one was going in there. So we became these kind of superstars of this tiny scene. So, yeah, it was really... really, really, really brilliant move. Never quite beaten that tour plan. That was really good.
But yeah, like that's that moment of like, oh, okay, people, I'm a star. I'm a rock star. Yeah, that's got to have a pretty big impression on
we
you.
We became stars in our little town at 15. So they were like, he's the guy in that band. They're in that band that toured our school at lunchtime.
What was the band that you went to go and see, the first gig that you saw, like the proper standalone gig that really kind of changed things for you, that like ignited that to the next level then?
One of the first gigs I have really fond memories of is a musical duo in New Zealand called The Front Lawn. Two guys called Don McGlashan and Harry Sinclair, and they're not really very well known outside of New Zealand. Don McGlashan is a very famous New Zealand musician, bands like Blam Blam Blam, The Mutton Birds, and Harry Sinclair's went on to make films. But one of their first acts was this sort of musical theatre duo, and for some reason one of them was staying at my house because his partner was a dancer who was a friend of my mum's. We often had dancers and theatre people staying in our house. So we got hired, when I say hired, unpaid, to be the ushers. I think I was probably around 9 or 10, around my breakdancing period. And so my brother and I, would every night we'd go to the theatre and we'd be the ushers and we'd watch the show. And it was this really cool show. Even then, I loved it. They had songs that told stories. They had funny songs. They've got this one song that goes, "G'day, how you doing? I haven't seen you for ages. Oh, quite a while. How you been? Oh, all right, yeah." You know, and the song is like this conversation that literally became, like, Jermaine and I, when we started Concords, they were one of our big influences, and we had a song called Bus right. Driver that was kind of really much like a tribute to their kind of style.
Right, yeah, I know it.
I was totally drawn into the magic of the theatre, of the world of it all, but also I think something about the way their songs told stories is, that's where I really connected with that, and that's something that's gone on to be a huge... still is something I love. I love songs when there's, you know, a story within the song.
You mentioned Jermaine. What were your... And I asked this question before, but I'm going to ask it again. What were your first impressions of him? Because often first impressions don't turn out to be accurate, but they're always pretty potent regardless.
I first met Jermaine at university. I guess it was mid-1990s. And he was a sort of tall, lanky, looked a sort of malnourished, kind of funky dude. Everyone was a little malnourished at that point. There was a lot of complex diets at that point, complex vitamins. And anyway, yeah, we were thrown together by chance into this comedy devise theatre group, and Taika Waititi was also in the group, and that's the first time I met him as well. And they were just funny guys. Everyone was trying to be kind of cool and alternative, but they kind of were cool and alternative at the same time. Do you know what I mean? Jermaine was very, he wore sort of beanies and baggy jeans and kind of lanky dude, yeah.
So what was the first, when you started before Flight of the Conchords were Flight of the Conchords, what was the first song that you kind of did together when you were like, this is working, this is okay, this idea that we've got on this song, it's kind of clicked here? What was that track?
Well, to be fair, a lot of things weren't working when we started the band. We were flatting together. It was this big old house, a big old wooden villa, which a lot of Wellington homes are, old, cold, turn-of-the-century villas. And we were all flatting there, lots of musicians and theatre folks, and we were all auditioning for various TV shows that were being made in Auckland in the Big Smoke, and no one was really getting any jobs. And Jermaine and I decided we should just start a band because the TV jobs, nothing was really happening. So then we started a band, which ironically ended up getting us a massive TV job. But we were in our flat teaching ourselves guitar. Neither of us really played guitar. And
all right.
And we just started writing songs that really only required one or two chords. And we had a lot of time to kill. So we would play the songs all day long, and our flatmates would sort of come and go, and by the end of the night they would, you know, we'd play the songs to the flatmates. And the first song what we did, so it's a rambling answer to the first song question, was Fudu Fafa, and it's a French,
yep.
It ended up being in the TV show and on the albums and stuff, and we'd play it live, and it still, it's funny, what was funny in the flat when we first did it for our flatmates then translated to these huge gigs like the Hollywood Bowl and like the, what's it, O2 Arena in London. We played these giant gigs with thousands and thousands of people, and we're still going Fudu Fafa exactly the same as to our flatmates as they came home from work and stuff, and the same things that were funny in that little flat were then funny for thousands of people. So it was really kind of beautiful seeing that.
Yeah, that's great. That's a really beautiful thing to happen, you know?
We were really lucky. And the first gig was a Fringe Festival gig, and we played that song, Fudu Fafa. We only had one song in the crowd. But yeah, that's great, do more. And we're like, we don't do it. We don't have any more. That's our song. We can play it again.
Je suis enchanté. Où est la bibliothèque? Voilà mon passeport. Ah, Gérald Depardieu. Baguette.
Baguette.
Fudu Fafa. Fudu Fafa Fafa. Fudu Fafa. Aïe. Fudu Fafa. Fudu Fafa Fafa.
Et maintenant le voyage à la supermarché. Pomme-la-mousse, ananas, jus d'orange, bœuf, soupe de jour, camembert, Jacques Cousteau, baguette. Oh.
Bonjour.
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 Bonjour monsieur.
Bonjour mon petit perroquet de chien.
Ça va?
Ça va, ça va?
Ça va.
Voilà la conversation dans le parc.
Où est le livre?
À la bibliothèque.
Et la musique danse?
À la discothèque.
Et les discothèques?
C'est bébé. Un, deux, trois, quatre. Fudu Fafa.
Fudu Fafa Fafa.
Fudu Fafa. Aïe. Fudu Fafa.
Où est la piscine?
Splish-splash. Hein?
Hein?
Oh, je ne comprends pas.
Parlez-vous le français? Parlez-vous le français?
Non.
Um, In terms of musicians that you've loved, Leonard Cohen is kind of one of them. When did you first fall in love with Laughing Len?
Leonard Cohen's one of my early faves. Simultaneously to listening to sort of funk and James Brown, my friends and I, my kind of high school crew, became very obsessed with Leonard Cohen and his sort of wry, dark humor. And I guess, again, I was 13, 14, and one of my strongest memories is singing along to Leonard Cohen, but my voice hadn't broken, and it was just really hard to successfully sing along to his songs. My friend Toby, who had this really great big deep voice, was like, he could do it such, he sounded so cool singing Leonard Cohen, like, I'm your man, you know, and I was like, I'm your man, but I still found him very funny.
Yeah, I think no matter how amazing his poetry and lyricism, if he'd had a squeaky voice, Leonard Cohen would not be.
He wouldn't be there. I don't think we'd have him.
Wouldn't have made it.
His voice is dynamite. Yeah.
I was going to ask you about Prototype, which is the record you did as the video kid.
Oh yeah, cool.
I was listening to it. It's a really cool record. It sounds really Flaming Lipsy.
Yep. Yeah.
And I've heard you cover Yoshimi, I think, once or twice on Little Things, and I just wondered about that. That's kind of your first album, I guess.
Yeah, I did. That was a record I did early 2000s, and it was sort of at a time when everyone had just got Pro Tools, like just figured out you could record yourself, and everyone was sort of getting Pro Tools and trying to learn how to use the software. We'd all played live a lot, but we're just starting to touch and tap into like the recording world, which really didn't exist much in Wellington. It wasn't an industry that you could sort of connect to. So that was me and my friends all trying to learn how to record, and I sort of started becoming fascinated by synthesizers and drum machines and the Flaming Lips Yoshimi, you know, the robots, and Do You Realize, it was around that sort of album, I think, was coming out, and
yeah.
I loved that album, I think, because it tells these stories. Yeah, huge fan. And then actually, I remember when Jermaine and I were on tour somewhere in the States, we managed to, I think, Bumbershoot or somewhere, we saw South by Southwest, Flaming Lips were playing live, and we were both like really into it and really into the experimental sort of craziness of it all. And
they're so good, man. They're so good.
Life. Yeah, that was definitely one of the best concerts I've ever seen. Yeah, yeah. And then they actually came to New Zealand, and they played this big New Zealand festival, and the opening of the show, they said, "This is the best concert you will ever see." It was like, gee, that's pretty arrogant. And then, but then afterwards, you're like, yeah, that was the best concert I've ever seen.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. I do like that thing. Well, like the start of a Flaming Lips concert is like the finale of anyone else's show, because it's like, we've got the flash bombs, the glitter cannons. This is only song number one. I love that.
The encore. It's sort of like the Paul McCartney pyrotechnics, you know?
It's
yeah,
so good.
Yeah.
With Flight of the Conchords, I mean, obviously this is kind of a music show, but the music for those two seasons, it was, you could tell how much love went into those songs. You know, they were so, they were like, you had the sort of narrative and the you know, the way it was directed and the look and all those different parts of it, but the music was like, it felt like you really put your whole beings into those songs, because they're all different, the arrangements are different, the instrumentation is different, and they cover all these different genres. That must have been quite a huge undertaking. I mean, it paid off, but wow, you know?
Yeah, it was so fun. I mean, because I love recording and music. I had a lot of that already in me. I'd toured with bands in New Zealand, and by this stage I'd done a few albums with my another band of mine, The Black Seeds, which is a reggae kind of funk band that I was in. And we'd spent a few years trying to figure out how Lee Scratch Perry got his sound. So my love for the recording studio, that was already there. And then when we started making the show, we joined with Mickey Petralia, who's the producer for all that music. And he'd worked with one of Jermaine and I's favorites, Beck. He worked on the Midnight Vultures album. And wow, Sonically, that was right in the pocket for us. You know, the song Deborah was one of the first songs that Jermaine and I heard that I feel like we could have become a band that was more like Beck on a Funny Day or Ween, but we happened to veer down the comedy. Yeah, our gigs ended up being in comedy clubs, not music bars. So we started writing more jokes rather than going down the what might be a more music path. But we did love that music. I think we were more following that path, like Ween or Beck. Do you know that song, Deborah? I'm Deborah. Yeah. You know, it's about a song. It's another song about a story about him falling in love with a woman at the supermarket and her sister. A cool step to you with a fresh pack of gum. And somehow I knew you were looking for some. Uh-oh. You know, he's like, so funny. Anyway, so Mickey Petrilli produced that. So that was, we were so excited. And yeah, when we're in the studio doing the Concord songs for the TV show, every song we tried to, we'd listen to the sound of the song, whether it was a Bowie song or the, you know, the rhinoceros, hippopotamus kind of early hip hop sound. And we'd try and capture something about those records that we would, not just referencing, but who it inspired us and we loved. We spent so much time trying to figure out, get that Bowie. We spent so much time trying to play Bowie songs. I mean, and we're not that competent. We can play instrument stuff, but we're not like, we couldn't quite achieve it. But somewhere in that gap of aiming high, somewhere in by missing the, you know, when you aim high, you don't quite get there, that's when there's always something kind of beautiful happens there.
Bowie loved comedians. He loved his comedy. Did you ever get any feedback from his camp at all?
So sadly, I didn't get to meet Bowie. Oh. And I felt like it was going to happen. We were so close. It was just like we were in America.
Go on.
He was in New York. We met someone who was on a... The closest I got to Bowie was a friend of a friend lived in an apartment in New York, and David Bowie was on the building. What do you call that in the UK? Like there's a, if there's like the co-op, if there's, you know, if there's like a co-op to look after the building. Do you have a word for that?
Oh, yeah. That word will do.
Yeah. And he was, so a friend of a friend was in the building that Bowie lived in the neighborhood, and they were having a community discussion about the park and how they were going to redevelop the park. And Bowie was on the board. that was the closest I got.
Which in itself is
yeah. So my friend Andy was like, "Yeah, I'm definitely going to that meeting to talk about the park."
You've got Bowie there complaining about like the swings not being oiled properly.
Yeah, so I got close, but I was so sad because I felt like, I just felt like I was going to meet him. And then he had heard the song. I did meet someone.
Oh, great.
Baz Luhrmann, the director. I spoke with Baz Luhrmann, who was a friend of David Bowie's. They lived in New York together. And he said that Bowie heard the song and liked it, but wasn't sure. Couldn't quite. And I get it. He was like, who are these guys? What is going on here? What is this? Are they taking the piss out of me? He didn't. I don't think he ever got a chance to really get into us. He was a bit more confused, but we were so close because we knew Ricky Gervais. That was a bit, you know, it was like we were so close. It just didn't quite happen in time.
Do it. What Bowie song should we play at this juncture? Pick something.
Oh, I was young Americans. I love the feel of that. I love it because of that sort of bit.
They pulled in just behind the bridge. He lays her down, he frowns. Gee, my life's a funny thing. Am I still too young? He kissed her then and there. She took his ring, took his babies. It took him minutes, took her nowhere. Heaven knows he'd have taken anything.
All night.
She wants a young American. A young American standing right through the picture window. She finds a slinky vagabond. He coughs as he passes, avoiding my sting. Heaven forbid she take anything. But the freak and his title for nothing. This is a step and cuts his hand. Showing nothing, it swoops like a song. She cries, where above Papa's hero's gone. A young American.
That was Young Americans, of course, by David Bowie, the choice of my guest to hit the first time this week, Brett McKenzie. And there's more to come with Brett, including how it felt working with the Muppets and winning an Academy Award, his new solo album, and if Flight of the Conchords will ever fly again. All coming up after the Six Music News.
Six.
Six Music. BBC Radio, Six Music.
We're the BBC News at 1:30. I'm Jason Kay. A group of 70 charities and community organisations is calling on the next Prime Minister to ensure that the poorest people are provided with sufficient support to cope with soaring energy bills. The letter's been signed by groups including Save the Children, Age UK and Shelter. Under current Treasury plans, every household in the UK will get £400 to help with energy bills this year, with those on the lowest incomes getting £1,200. Rochelle Earwaker from the Joseph Rowntree Foundation said the situation was extremely concerning.
Throughout history, it has been government's role to provide support to households who need it when you are in a time of crisis. We need to see that the government at least doubles that support to low-income households right now, or we are going to be facing a winter of truly terrifying circumstances.
A teenage boy has died after going into the sea at Skegness last night. He's yet to be identified. Lincoln police say they received a high volume of calls about missing people on the coast yesterday, but the others were all found safe and well. Legal proceedings have ended against six people accused of breaching coronavirus restrictions when they attended a vigil in London for Sarah Everard. They were due to stand trial in November. Angus Crawford reports.
Sarah Everard was kidnapped and murdered by the serving Metropolitan Police firearms officer Wayne Cousins. 10 days later, after an official event was blocked by police, hundreds of people went to Clapham Common in South London to hold a vigil. Six people who attended were due to face trial this November for breaching COVID rules, and if convicted, could have faced hundreds of pounds in fines. Today, the Crown Prosecution Service confirmed the cases had now been discontinued because the legal test for a prosecution had not been met.
Police Scotland are investigating a threat made online towards J.K. Rowling. The Harry Potter author had posted on Twitter that she felt very sick after hearing that the writer Sir Salman Rushdie had been stabbed. She then shared screenshots of one of the replies, which said, "Don't worry, you're next." A new reduced timetable is in place on the West Coast mainline because of what the operator Avanti called severe staff shortages. The company said it usually had around 400 drivers volunteering for overtime on rest days, but that number's dropped to about 50. These passengers at London Euston station were asked what they thought of the changes.
It would probably mean as well that the cost of trains will go up because there's less, more people are wanting to go there. It's just going to make it even more difficult.
They're already quite busy as well. They're going to be really crowded and difficult to kind of get onto.
It's definitely be an inconvenience to some people, but I mean, the train drivers obviously got a cause to fight for.
The Met Office says there's still a significant risk of further wildfires, despite a yellow warning for thunderstorms due to spread across the UK from Scotland and Northern Ireland tomorrow. Forecasters say that fires are still possible because the ground's been dry for so long. That's Six Music News. There's more at 2:30.
For radio, music and podcasts.
Listen to Six Music anywhere on the BBC Sounds app.
Some people say that rappers don't have feelings. We have feelings.
We have feelings.
Some people say that we are not rappers.
We're rappers.
That hurts our feelings.
Hurts our feelings when you think we're not rappers.
Some people say that rappers are invincible.
We're invincible.
We're invincible. But you are about to hear our true stories.
Real experiences.
Autobiographical raps.
Things that happened to us.
All true. Bring the rhyme.
I make a meal for my friends. Try to make it delicious. Try to keep it nutritious. Create wonderful dishes. Not one of them thinks about the way I feel. Nobody compliments the meal. No one even mentions my casserole.
I got the feelings, I got the feelings.
You could have said something nice about my professor role.
Here's a little story to bring a tear to your eye. I was shopping for a wetsuit to scuba dive, but every suit I tried was too big around the thighs, and the assistant suggests I try a lady size.
I got the feelings, I got the feelings.
I'm not gonna wear a lady's wetsuit, I'm a man. Small man's wetsuit, please.
It's my birthday, 2003. Waiting for a call from my family. They forgot about me.
I got hurt feelings. I got hurt feelings.
The day after my birthday is not my birthday, Mom.
I call my friends, say let's go into town, but they're all too busy to go into town. So I go by myself, I go into town, then I see all my friends, they're all in town.
I got the feeling.
watch that movie, Made in Manhattan?
Have you ever been told your ass is too big?
Have you ever been asked if your hair is a wig?
Have you ever been told you're mediocre in bed?
Have you ever been told you got a weird shaped head?
Has your family ever forgotten you and driven away?
Once again, they forgot about
you. Were you ever called to school you took drama?
Have you ever been told that you look like a llama?
Tears of a rapper.
Don't wanna make a rapper cry, then watch what
I'm
you say.
I'm crying tears of a rapper.
Pouring like the bullets out my eyes.
Cold-rated tears of a rapper.
These are the tears of a rapper now.
These are diamond tears of a rapper.
These are the bulletproof 24 karat gold tears of a rapper.
Hello and welcome back to The First Time with me, Matt Everett. This is the show where we ask an influential musician about the pivotal musical moments that made them who they are today. And we were just playing Hurt Feelings by Flight of the Conchords, performed and co-written by my guest this week, Brett McKenzie. Clearly, if you watched the two seasons of Flight of the Conchords TV show and heard their two albums, you'll know how brilliantly crafted and recorded their music is. So I asked Brett if he had a favourite Flight of the Conchords track, perhaps even the one you just heard.
Well, Hurt Feelings is definitely a favourite of mine. I remember writing that one, and we were so amused by the idea of these tough hip-hop sort of gangster dudes singing about their feelings. And yeah, I sing in that about getting a wetsuit, about not being able to fit a man's wetsuit. There's just some autobiographical material on that one, just some truth to it.
Really? Okay. So,
and there's a lyric in that about how I go to a shop and I want to try on a wetsuit, and then they suggest I try a lady's wetsuit because I'm too small and I'm too embarrassed and I get upset. And it's funny because I do actually want to get a wetsuit, but I'm too embarrassed to go to the wetsuit shop now because I've got this lyric. It's going to be too ironic when I go in there and they're like, you might need a small man's wetsuit. I can't do it. So I haven't got a wetsuit, so I just don't go swimming in the cold New Zealand water.
I mean, this is a question that everybody asks you, and I know why the answer is probably going to be no in terms of doing... not another series, but doing another album even, because the amount of work did seem to be completely insane to create those shows. But would you ever consider doing another Flight of the Conchords record or a full season? Or is it just like there is no time left in your life to be able to make that happen?
Very unlikely that I would make more TV. I found it very, like you say, it was an absurd amount of work. And
yeah.
And just as we finished up, I had my first child. My kids are now, it's so long ago, my daughter's now 13, 13, 10 and 7 now, and there's no way I could give myself to a TV show that takes, we would work 10 hours, 11 hours a day for 100 days straight. I couldn't do that now. But Jermaine, he's carried on working on TV, and he always tells me, he's like, it's never been as bad, it's never as hard. He's like, because I've got this sort of trauma of like, I can't do it, it's too stressful.
I can't do that again.
That's not, I've done so many things, nothing's ever been as bad as Concord. But he assures me it's not as hard. But the recording, obviously for me, I love the music and I love the idea of recording. To me, that sounds more like, oh yeah, I can handle that. I can cope with recordings and I know how to do that and I feel comfortable. But the TV side intimidates me. So, and I don't think I would, certainly wouldn't want to revisit that world. I think now it would be weird. Give it a little bit more time. If when we're really completely grey and these two old dudes... I think it might get funnier again to be like,
yeah, you're right.
To be like good. A couple of, you know, really grey sort of Santa Clausy looking dudes singing "Too Many Dicks on the Dance Floor." I would find that funny, but I think there's something,
yeah.
Something's a little sad about 40-year-olds singing dick jokes. I find it a little depressing, and also something about, I've got a few comedian friends here, like 20s, it's great, yeah, you're touring, doing jokes, no big deal. You know, it's like, it's funny, it's ridiculous, what a crazy job. 30s, yeah, it's a crazy job, this is crazy, I can earn money, look, I earn so much money doing jokes, doing stupid, silly things. Then 40, you have kids, and they're like, what's your job, Dad? And you're like, yeah, I just do silly stuff, and that's how we get paid. I know, something about it feels a bit like, there's a lull in comedy in your 40s, where you've got to do something different, I think, or something. I don't know. And then it's great again when you're a bit older. It's like, yeah, that's my dad. He's that old dude rapping. He's rapping. He's a 60-year-old. He's doing his rap about being a rhinoceros.
Yeah. What was the first Muppet song that you remember from your childhood? Because they had a massive effect on me. Obviously, it was kind of dead entertaining, but like, to this day, like something like Rainbow Connection has got this sort of philosophical poignancy to it, like same for kind of halfway up the stairs, or
so beautiful.
Even Mana Mana's got like a Dadaist sort of quality to it, yes. And obviously Paul Williams was a genius. But what was the one that you remember from your childhood that really first made an impact on you?
I think one of the ones, the first Muppet song that is locked somewhere deep in my subconscious is Animal playing Fever.
See, I'm laughing already. All I need to, like,
he goes, I can't actually even remember the name of the singer. I just remember Animal. He just takes over and he's meant to be doing like this low key drum part, and he just starts doing this giant solos over the top of the song, and the singer's like, stop, be quiet, be quiet.
Cause, yeah, I mean, this is a lovely name drop, you know, because I got a chance to interview Kermit and Piggy, and you must have had a similar thing.
I know them well. Yeah, I know them well. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Something in my hardwired brain just, I mean, obviously they're real, but they're real.
It's such a magical feeling. We did a show in Wellington. We did it was like a Henson tribute show where we got the Muppets, the Sesame Street characters and Fraggle Rock characters to Wellington with a symphony orchestra. And I hosted the show. It was on stage with the puppeteers. And I sang Rainbow Connection with Kermit. And Miss Piggy, you were saying, did the thing with Miss Piggy. Big Bird came out. You know, it's so beautiful and so fun. And honestly, the audience were just, they're laughing and they're crying. And like these grown men are weeping so there's something about this nostalgia of these. They're just so, for people who grew up with the Muppets, just really magical and really moving. And actually, that was one of the first times. That was a few years ago. And it was funny for me because I'd spent my whole life doing shows pretty much to make people laugh, and that's the main objective. You go on stage and you know it's going well when they're laughing, and I'd never really done a show where people cried. it's not a reaction you get. I mean, I guess if you do drama or something like that, maybe that's part of you, you're more familiar with that, but comedians, you don't really get that sense of, well, I'd never had people weeping, being moved to tears. They're laughing maybe to the point where they're crying a little bit, but not genuinely weeping, just through a swelling emotion. And but with this Muppets concert, yeah, these audience would be crying and then laughing, and I really loved that. And I loved something about that triggered something new for me, where I was like, oh, it's amazing. Jim Henson allowed these characters to not only be outrageously funny and hilarious, but he let the space for the songs to move people, and the songs didn't have to just be funny. They could also be quite emotional and powerful. And I learnt working with the puppets in that world that there's something about puppets that's very different to seeing real people and seeing animation. There's something that about humans and watching puppets, and maybe it's from hundreds of years of that being something we've grown up with, but they really directly to the subconscious. Is something
absolutely.
About you accept a puppet emotionally very deeply, very quickly. It's very unusual. It's different to an actor. You just let them in immediately. Yeah.
I was watching the footage of you getting your Academy Award. You seemed incredibly together. Was that like, there panic underneath, or were you just genuinely
so
together?
So panicked. I can't even, I'm so panicked. I have this weird.
Because you seem like really calm.
No, I was in like another out of body experience. I honestly can't even remember it. I remember sitting in the seat and then it just goes black until backstage with Tom Cruise and Oprah Winfrey. It was so weird. But yeah, I have this sort of slight. I have a weird slight fear of like public speaking, ironically, even though I've done these huge gigs and concerts. I don't particularly like public speaking. I don't really know why. I used to do it at school, but it's sort of something I get a little nervous with, and like a lot of people. And so I had to practice my speech, you know, it's like practicing the day before. I was like, just in case. I mean, it was quite weird. There were only two nominations that year. It was like this weird anomaly in the music category. And I was so lucky. And yeah, but I was freaked out, but yeah, it was so cool though. What a great day.
We're going to get onto the new record in a second. I wanted to ask you about The Simpsons. I wanted to ask you about Quillaby, which was the Morrissey-esque kind of character. It was you and Tim Long that did this song, yeah?
Yeah, this was so fun. This was during COVID, during lockdown, and I got the call from my friend Tim Long, who writes for Simpsons, and he wrote the episode that Jermaine and I were in. We were in The Simpsons, so I have already connected with them, and he wrote to me and was like, oh, I've got this idea to this Morrissey-esque character, Quillaby. And
the esque is very important.
And, yeah, very important. You know, would you like to write a song for it? Or a few songs? And I was I love Morrissey's music. I love the Smiths. I love that joyous tragedy. Come Armageddon, come. Every day's like Sunday. And I love how funny and how dark and but catchy that is. And so he wanted the songs kind of in that kind of zone. What's the song? Everyone is horrid except
me and you. And possibly you.
That's it, right? And and possibly you.
Every day I try to smile, but can't help but frown. Every day I draw my bath and pray I will drown. I step out my door and I take a deep breath, turn back inside and pray for my death. Cause everyone is horrid except me and possibly. Let me tell you a tale to answer your query. In Manchester the people were loyal and kind, and I hated them.
Someone should have sedated them.
They lacked subtlety and nuance. I definitely knew once I was five there was no point to their lives. Cause everyone is horrid except me and possibly.
And it was funny because Tim, I wrote this, worked on the songs, and some people, like if you love a musician, I find it quite easy to write like them, you know, because I sort of know that Smith sound, and I was like, oh, I know how to do this. You just sort of, I'm Morrissey, and you just jangle away on the guitar, and you sort of make it kind of sweet and catchy, but moany, and you sound quite a lot like Morrissey. So yeah, had a ball, and then they got Benedict Cumberbatch to play the part, and I recorded him.
He did a great job as well,
so
man, didn't
good.
He?
He was so good. He was. It was a weird 2 a.m. Zoom for me because he was in London, and I was directing him, bossing him around, telling him to, you know, how to sing it, and he was very professional. Massive shout out to Benedict Cumberbatch, and he nailed it. Because some actors think they can nail it. They think if they just pretend to be the character, they'll be able to sing. But he really can sing, and he was awesome. And then it came out, and then Morrissey was outraged. He was horrified about how he was being accused of ultra right wing sort of conservative attitude, and he didn't really have anything to stand on. So anyway, he wrote this really angry response, and then it kind of blew up a bit as a little news story for a little while. And it was funny because so it's just what happens. Yeah,
I would take that as the most incredible form of flattery. If A, you're in The Simpsons, and B, there's someone writing a song that kind of, because you don't do that unless you love it. You can't do that unless you love it.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't know if you've seen the episode, but it's a really funny bit where he's shooting at concerts, they shoot T-shirts into the audience, like a T-shirt cannon.
Yeah.
But he's shooting sausages because, you know, it was really funny.
It was very funny.
Yeah, he took it way too seriously. I'm not quite sure. I mean, he's obviously an unusual character.
Songs Without Jokes. This is the record that's kind of imminent.
Yeah.
Like, you've name-checked lots of artists, kind of like Steely Dan and Harry Nilsson and Randy Newman. I wondered where the kind of setting was for the album then for you. What world did you try and create? Because it's never just a bunch of songs. They always inhabit a certain place, don't they?
Yeah. Well, this was kind of a new thing for me. I wanted to. I'd been doing these Muppets things and finished Concords, and I still write a lot of songs for films. And by day, that's sort of the gig I've got. You know, the Simpsons songs and working on a new Simpsons one at the moment, actually, and it's really fun and everything.
Cool.
But sometimes at night, I would write these other songs. I'd be sitting around my guitar. Kids were asleep, gone to bed, and I'd be just sort of meandering around, and I'd come up with these songs, and I was like, what do I do with these ones? They're not really funny, they're just kind of little moments and little ideas. And simultaneously, I'd become friends with these amazing LA session musicians working on the Muppets films and other film songs. And I one day I connected with Leland Sklar, who's this legendary bass player, plays with James Taylor and Phil Collins and so right. many amazing records, hundreds of records over the years. And he looks like Gandalf, but very cool. Like if Gandalf was a really cool bass player.
What's his name
he's
again?
Leland Sklar. In the music world, he's very famous. And he's got this great book, actually. Whenever he meets people, he gets them to flip the bird and he takes a photo. And he's just put out this book with about 3,000 pictures of famous with musicians and people around the world flipping the bird. It's really cool. Anyway, it's more plug for his book. Anyway, I was talking to him and we've been working on these film songs. And I said, I've got these songs. I sort of like the idea. I was thinking about trying to do some non-comedy song, you know, non-movie, non-comedy songs. And he was like, oh, that sounds great. I'm in. And all these session players were like, yeah, that sounds really cool. I'll do it. And so suddenly I had this A-team band wanting to play. And I was like, I've got to do this. And I was working with Mickey Petralia, the producer. And he was like, this would be so fun. Let's do it. You know, it would be so fun to work on something where we don't have to tell a story for a film or the songs don't have to do anything. It's not a character for The Simpsons. It doesn't have to be anything and doesn't have to be cut down for the animation or anything. And it was kind of a freedom to do that. And so we embarked on this project, not really knowing what we were going to do, but knowing that synths and all these elements of, you know, from my life of things I've loved, drum machines and synths and 70s and 80s music, it was going to be in that world somewhere. And we didn't know exactly what, but that's sort of come out definitely with an 80s, a sort of 80s, late 70s feel.
And like, did it feed a part of your soul that's kind of different to the stuff that you've been doing? Did you get a lot out of it that maybe you weren't expecting because it was different framework?
Oh yeah, it's opened up a whole new kind of door for me for songwriting, so I'm loving it. Yeah, and I've written a whole lot more songs, and I've just started rehearsing a band for we're going on tour, and yeah, it's just a new kind of thing. So it's exciting. Yeah,
yeah. So more of the same then?
Yeah, yeah, definitely more. And it's funny, this the song's called Songs Without Jokes, because I said I'm doing this record. First thing was always, is it comedy? Because they kind of had a hunch, they could tell. But I was like, they're like, it could be comedy, it might not be with this guy, what's he up to? And then I was like, no, it's not comedy, it's just songs. Which is a funny thing to describe. It's like, song. I was going to call it Song Songs. So I called it Songs Without Jokes to help the audience, because I feel like they're going to be like, the first thing is going to be, what's going on? Where's the rhinoceros?
And you're taking it on tour, you're coming over here, we're going to be seeing it like live. Great.
Yeah, gonna tour and it's gonna, I think it's gonna find its way a bit as it goes. Do you know what I mean? It's kind of a new thing. So I think one thing that's quite odd is I've got the first shows in New Zealand in 3 weeks, and I remember doing, you know, first Concord shows, you when you add a new song it's so stressful, but you know you've got your old song to play next, so you're all right. This is going to be a whole night of new songs.
The opposite.
It's going to be so stressful.
It's normally the bit, we're going to do a new one. We'll go to the bar. Now it's like the whole thing is everyone's going to be at the bar.
So I've got to navigate the audience. Like, don't worry, guys, it's going to be okay. I've had one idea. I was going to get a piano instrumental version of the whole album to play in the background when people are sitting down in the theater. So it's like they already know it. So like, I've heard this one. I think I know this one. Oh, it's because they were playing it in the bar when I came in.
And the final question, we always ask everyone to pick the last song that we play out on. It can be one of yours, it can be one of someone else's, it can be something you heard, anything you want.
Let's do Nick Drake's Saturday Sun. Let's do that one. It's such a good weekend chill song. It's great.
Wonderful. Then that's the song we'll go out on. Thank you so much. It's been lovely to speak to you.
Saturday sun came early one morning in a sky so clear and blue. But Saturday sun came without warning, so no one knew what to do. Saturday sun brought people and faces that didn't seem much in their day. When I remember those people and places, they were really too good in their way, in their way, in their way. But Saturday and see me today. Think about stories with reason and rhyme circling through your brain. And think about people in their season and time returning again and again and again. And again, but Saturday sun.
That was Nick Drake's Saturday Sun, the final choice of my guest on the first time this week, Brett McKenzie. And Brett's new album, Songs Without Jokes, is incoming, and he's touring the UK this September. And that's the end of this week's show. If you head to BBC Sounds, you can catch up with previous episodes, including First Times with Herbie Hancock, Tim Minchin, Franz Ferdinand's Alex Kapranos, Shun Kuti, Licky Lee, and many more from the archive. We'll be back next Sunday. Until then, I've been Matt Everett. Thanks for listening.
For a day gone by.